NASA's strategies for space exploration and space cycles. You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Marion Summerall, filling in for Brennan Byrne. NASA and space leaders around the world are working together to plan out objectives and create the low Earth orbit microgravity strategy. The goal? To shape how space experts, commercial industries, and space enthusiasts can work together to shape future space exploration in low Earth orbit. We'll speak with NASA's Robin Gatens about the strategies and science ahead in space. Then, what happens when women get their menstrual cycle in space? When the first American woman Sally Ride went to space, NASA suggested sending her with 100 tampons for a week-long trip. We'll speak with the University of Central Florida's Amy Foster about the history of women in space and how space travelers have their cycle in space. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? For over 65 years, NASA has benefited humanity by exploring space and answering big questions about our universe. From crewed missions to science on the International Space Station, NASA has played a key role in space exploration. But a lot of planning and research goes into space travel. And as the space station nears retirement, NASA, commercial partners, and international partners have worked together to create objectives and goals in a new low Earth orbit microgravity strategy plan. NASA's plan outlines goals in science fields and highlights agendas for things like international cooperation, research, public involvement, and exploration agendas for the future. Now the draft has been made, and NASA is asking for public input on the objectives and agendas in the strategy, including new ideas for commercial platforms in low Earth orbit. Here to talk more about NASA's plans for exploring low Earth orbit is Robin Gatens, the director of the International Space Station and acting director of the Commercial Space Flight Division within the Space Operations Mission Directorate at NASA headquarters. Robin, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's so nice to be here.
I'm so glad you're here, and I'm really excited to get into this topic because NASA's low Earth orbit microgravity strategy is in the draft phase. And for those that are listening that maybe don't know what that is, can you just kind of give a brief background on what this strategy is and how it works?
Absolutely. This is our vision for this strategy, is to develop goals and objectives to lead the next generation of human presence in low Earth orbit, to advance microgravity science, technology, and exploration. So that's a lot of words. What we're trying to do is put out goals and objectives that will guide NASA's future activities in low Earth orbit. When we say next generation, we mean beyond the life of the current International Space Station. So we're using this to really guide our future vision and what we want to do next, and how do we engage our partners in industry, the public, our international partners in this journey that we're on and have been on in low Earth orbit for decades and going into the future. This is brand new. We have only been working on this year, and we released it for public comment on August 26th, and we have the comment period open until the end of September. And then we're going to be taking all the feedback and refining these goals and objectives and then using them going forward to guide our plans for future human platforms in low Earth orbit.
What are some of the biggest strategies? We have a ton of missions coming up that are some of the first, right? We're going back to the moon. We're exploring Mars on a deeper level and just really exploring our universe like never before. So what are some of those main goals in the strategy?
What are we doing in low Earth orbit? Well, we've been in low Earth orbit for decades. We've been living and working in space on the International Space Station. We've been conducting science. We've been learning how the human body adapts to long periods of time and microgravity, because all of that helps us as we're going to venture out beyond low Earth orbit. We've really been using low Earth orbit as our proving ground and our test bed to get us ready to go beyond. But even when we start going to the moon and Mars, we want to stay and continue activities in low Earth orbit. It's going to be continue to be a place where we want to have a long-term presence. Some of the big strategies are around what science do we want to continue to conduct in this microgravity environment. We have learned so much in science on the International Space Station. I call it the decade of results because we are really cranking out the results. So science, first and foremost, we want to continue to do technology demonstrations in low Earth orbit that help us get ready for those missions beyond low Earth orbit. So things like our life support systems, advanced materials, robotics, you know, automation, things that we want to use in that trip to Mars is better demonstrated in the microgravity environment of low Earth orbit first. Also, our big initiatives include our international partners. So the space station has been an amazing international partnership. We're up to 117 countries and areas that have done some activity on the International Space Station and counting. We continue to add more, and we want to keep those partners. We want to expand those partnerships, and they're very interested in continuing activities in low Earth orbit. We want to enable a commercial economy in the low Earth orbit. We have commercial partners who are now today providing transportation to the International Space Station. What we're enabling is the destinations now. So when we retire the International Space Station, we are going to have commercially owned and operated platforms that are going to take over in low Earth orbit. So this strategy speaks to what is that infrastructure and how do we partner with industry to do that? And then we want to very much continue operations in low Earth orbit and join operations with our partners, and also use it as a place to engage the public, but also engage our students and use it as a place for continued inspiration as we go forward. So even though we're doing these hugely inspirational missions to the moon and on to Mars that are going to be very engaging, low Earth orbit and our continued access there allows us opportunities to do that every day. We have astronauts in space every day on the International Space Station, and we're going to continue that flight cadence in the future as well.
Why is it so important to involve the public and get public feedback from this, right? There's that saying that space is for everyone. And what we've seen on the ISS over the years is that, you know, it connects people to space that are on Earth because they are able to see those videos, they are able to see those photos. So when you were making this strategy, was that something that really struck out? Was, yes, we need the opinions of space enthusiasts and companies and analysts, but we really need the public.
Right. Well, this follows the strategy and the process we used for our Moon to Mars strategy. We took a lot of lessons learned from that process. And in that process, we engaged the public and we got public feedback on the Moon to Mars architecture as well, and found that to be very valuable in helping to capture input from not just our industry partners, our international partners, our you know, space enthusiasts who are academic institutions, for example, but also the general public who are very interested and follow, as you said, the activities that NASA does every day. So it's important to capture those as well, which is why we put this out for the general public. And we're looking very, very much forward to that feedback.
And Robin, you've been with NASA for 39 years, right? I mean, that is an extremely amazing career. And with this plan is the discussion of new partnerships, a new space station. I mean, is that more of a hard conversation for you, or are you just excited for the future?
I have so many emotions about this, but mostly excitement. So you're right. I've been with NASA 39 years. I started on the International Space Station program back in the earliest design phase, working in the lab, you know, on the earliest life support systems for it. I've been with this program for decades. What an amazing privilege, first of all, to be able to follow a program like this all the way from its inception through these operations that we have now and the benefits this platform is creating for everyone here on Earth. But also, so I care very deeply about this legacy of the International Space Station And we're not done yet. We're going to continue to get everything we can out of this platform through the end of the decade. But at the same time, I really care about planning for the future in a way that we have continuity, that we can continue the science and the technology and the inspiration and all of these things that we're accomplishing on station today, that that lives on. We've grown a whole industry around having this destination in low Earth orbit and regular access 24/7, over 23 years, going on 24 years of continuous presence on the International Space Station. What an amazing achievement. And this strategy helps us set us up for this transition in a way that provides that continuity. Even though we're going to be moving off of station, we're going to be moving to these exciting new commercially owned and operated platforms.
We want to continue these things, continuing those partnerships, continuing involving the public. And with the strategy, though, there are a couple new things, right? Let's touch on some of the new goals for the future that the strategy touches on, keeping with the old, but what can we be excited about?
In the strategy, yes, we have exciting new goals for our science area, for ways that we can use these platforms, even beyond how we're using the space station today, to really practice how we're going to be operating on a trip to Mars and potentially doing demonstrations of those kinds of operations. I'm excited about the expansion of our international ways that we can cooperate and collaborate with our international partners. And I'm excited about all the new players and actors we're getting from other countries that want to participate and partner with NASA. That's super exciting. I'm very passionate, and I do a lot of speaking to students today at this point in my career. I'm really excited. In this strategy, we're being very intentional about how do we use low Earth orbit to do those kinds of student engagements, to really offer opportunities for students to fly projects to low Earth orbit and develop curriculum. You know, we want to nurture this next generation of scientists that are good at doing science in space. And so how can we be very intentional in the strategy about setting very specific objectives in that area?
A lot of people grew up with this space station and have known the space station. But when you look at the future and you look at eventually when the space station does retire, you're not thinking just about, okay, how do we continue this? You're also thinking about improving it for the younger generations, those younger space enthusiasts who will now grow up with different methods of space travel in low Earth orbit. That's really fascinating. I love that perspective.
Yeah, I expect we're going to see not only U.S. government and other space agency government astronauts flying to these platforms, but we're going to see private citizens. We're going to be seeing citizen scientists, perhaps, flying with their science and being able to conduct that their own science, rather than having a government astronaut do that for them. And then just some of the, we're already thinking today, you know, the space station has been an amazing platform. It's been like a test kitchen where we've tried and really expanded its capabilities. But we're learning that the way that we do science, where we launch an experiment, the science is very much a packaged experiment. It's conducted and then the results are returned to Earth. And the principal investigator has to, you know, see what they got, kind of, and then refly to do it again, to really replicate a ground-based lab in space where the science can be more iterative. Hey, I noticed that. Now I want to change a parameter and go again without having to refly. Those are the kinds of capabilities that I think are just going to enable more rapid science and advance the rate of discovery. So I'm really excited that the new space stations will have some of those additional capabilities.
And it's bringing more people together, right? It's bringing more of the world together, more of the public, those citizens like you mentioned. Robin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to talk about this.
That was Robin Gatens, the director of the International Space Station and acting director of the Commercial Spaceflight Division within the Space Operations Mission Directorate at NASA headquarters. Still to come, space cycles. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? You are listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Marion Summerall, filling in for Brennan Byrne. When NASA started allowing women to go to space, it was a new agenda, and NASA was concerned about women's health in space, including when they got their menstrual cycle. But does space impact the female body? Does space impact a woman's menstrual cycle? Here to answer those questions and talk about the history of women in space is Amy Foster, a University of Central Florida space historian focusing on technology and gender. Amy, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So, I really want to talk about the history of women having their cycles in space. And I know that this was an argument back in the day for women not to be astronauts, right?
It's less so about women becoming astronauts, more about women in aviation. That's okay. Really where it kind of got started. So by the time NASA's selecting women for the astronaut corps, that's largely been settled. But there certainly were discussions and debates about having women in space in the 1960s as a way to compete with the Soviet Union. They put Valentina Tereshkova up in 1963, and the United States had not done anything. And so that certainly was part of the conversation. But really, those largely physical jobs, there were concerns about whether women would be able to handle the pressure when they're on their menstrual cycle. And so women in aviation were more challenged by the idea that they wouldn't be physically or mentally capable of flying when they were on their cycle. But, you know, one of the wonderful things is you did have women who were pilots almost from the very beginning. One of the kind of fascinating things about aviation itself is it was a brand new technology in the early 20th century. And so there were no rules about who could and could not fly. And so they were showing they could do the job. And largely one of the historical questions is, could women fly, but should women fly? And that's really where the questions about how a woman performs when she's on her period was something that many people were asking. I think by the time, you know, we get to the 1960s, women had been pilots for the military as the WASPs. It's as much about kind of the social expectations about what women should do that kind of the United States had to get over for it to create opportunities for women at every point in their cycle to become astronauts.
Sally Ride, the first American woman, was going to space. NASA didn't really know how to prepare her for her cycle, right? And she was asked, what was it, like 100 tampons was enough, right?
Every astronaut takes up a personal preference kit, so they can kind of put anything in it they want. But for the women astronauts, that included anything that they might need. But just like in the early 1960s, when flight surgeons were thinking about what's going to happen to the human body when we put a person in space, the same question was asked, what's going to happen to a woman when we put her in space? Basically, flight surgeons and engineers simply didn't know. And they wanted to prepare for all possibilities. You know, one of the concerns was that microgravity might negatively affect a woman's cycle. There might be retrograde flow, at which point, you know, when your body isn't flushing out that blood, you know, and the uterine layer, does it, you know, become a septic situation? I mean, there's definitely were medical concerns. And the last thing they wanted to happen was a woman would start her period and bleed profusely to the point they need to bring the mission home early. But really asking the question, you know, about what do you need and how many of these do you need? NASA was prepared. And you know, and Sally's response was sort of, this is ridiculous. It was basically NASA wanted to be prepared, you know, for all possibilities. But basically, just like with many issues, the women said, you know, this is a non-issue until it's an issue. Yes, we'll be prepared. but, you know, we're not really going to worry about it. In addition to, you know, just how do we manage the cycle, the engineers in particular, very male, didn't like asking these questions. But one of the pieces of technology on the space shuttle was the toilet. And there were certainly concerns about any additional fluids that might cause problems with the toilet. There were concerns. And again, if the toilet breaks, they have to bring a mission home early because that's a necessary piece of equipment. Because all of the astronauts, male or female, are volunteers, how they, at least for the women, if they choose to control their menstrual cycle by taking birth control pills to suppress it over the course of their flights, that is an option. If they don't want to do that, that still is their choice. And they largely just deal with it as it happens. And it hasn't been an issue to this point. There's been no flight that's been brought home because of a medical issue related to menstruation.
A lot of the astronauts, whether it's bodily fluid, whether it's sweat, I mean, we're testing the human body up there, right? Mm-hmm. So if anything, it'd be really interesting to look at if your cycle changes in space. Talking about earlier, like a lot of people were scared that it could impact a woman's menstrual cycle. And we know that things like bone density impact the human body. And astronauts get back on Earth and they say their legs feel like jello. Have there been any reports that maybe a cycle has changed or anything like what you're saying? I mean, or is it just, again, we'll come to it when we get there?
In terms of medical data, certainly NASA collects that. One of the kind of interesting things that NASA does is whether a person is an active astronaut or a retired astronaut, every year they go back to Johnson Space Center and go through a full medical exam. There are concerns about the long-term impact of spending any time in microgravity, as well as outside the protective elements of Earth's atmosphere. So what are the impacts of radiation long term on the human body? And, you know, unfortunately, one of the things that NASA has noticed, even though we have spent our time largely in low Earth orbit, is there is a higher rate of cancer among the astronaut corps than there is the general American public. But in terms of knowing whether women have reported changes to their cycle while they're in space, NASA collects the data. There are some studies that they've published, but they still have to keep kind of that some of that data private,
right?
Certainly names. And so they have to be careful in terms of how they write up that data for mm-hmm. publication, because once again, if you talk about, we've gathered data from the flights from 1990 to 1991, well, we know who all was on those flights.
Right.
And so
there's a little over 600, almost 700 astronauts. It can be easy to look at dates like that. Right.
But yeah, I mean, one of the things that NASA has been long concerned about is the issue of radiation. You know, no space vehicle has been able to shield the astronauts effectively. Part of the reason that we see this higher rate of cancer is we know the radiation does have an impact. So what NASA's policy has always been since they brought women into the astronaut corps was no woman who was currently pregnant or trying to get pregnant is in the flight rotation. Mm. All right. So NASA's concern is to protect not only the astronaut, but the child. And so, you know, if women are trying to get pregnant, they have to report that to NASA so that they can be taken out of the flight rotation. And then once they are either no longer trying to get pregnant or the child is born, they clear that medical physical again, and then they're back in the flight rotation.
Okay, I see. And I mean, that's really interesting stuff of how much thought goes into something that, you know, all of these female astronauts are experiencing or maybe have experienced. And I think the big question that everyone is wondering, and including myself, is it may sound silly, but is it different up there? Is it the same? Like, I'm sure that when I first was looking into this, I was thinking in my head of like, well, it's space, right? You're floating in zero gravity. Is it different? Can you go about your daily activities as an astronaut?
In my conversations, and particularly with Ray Seddon, she's the one who's been most open about that. And certainly as a physician, she was the person that I was most likely to ask her.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like nothing was ever really a problem. You know, the body does benefit from gravity, right?
Right.
So you know, certainly when we start talking about the toilet, there's a fan included to kind of create this vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, for any woman who's experienced menstrual cramps, part of what the body is doing is there is a mild contraction essentially happening to
right.
to force that layer out of the body. Don't know of any situations where it's been a problem. Certainly there has never been a medical situation like that for a woman that they've needed to bring that flight home.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm reading into that to say, no, it's never been an issue.
Right.
But it's simply something that women have been able to manage just fine.
Mm-hmm. I know it's an interesting thing. You never really think about, you know, hey, if I were an astronaut one day and I got my cycle in space, what would happen? Right.
You know, the one thing about all of these astronauts is they just want to fly. And and so asking them to hold off on having a family, that, again, it's something that they commit to. For women in the astronaut corps, it's a comparable situation. If they are committing to that flight, that also means delaying a family.
Right. And just kind of, there's so many interesting things that happen to female body specifically, right? That there's so many other things to think about.
But I think it is still challenging for, you know, for the general public to talk about menstruation.
Mm-hmm. And maybe even a little bit tougher for astronauts, right? Because they're kind of that public figure,
right?
For like NASA astronauts, we know who they are. We see their photo and we see them getting up ready for launch. So it might be a little tougher for them to kind of be open about it. Not only is it kind of like, you know, maybe a little shunned to talk about it in a public setting, I'm sure it's even harder for them.
Right. So certainly they're talking to the flight surgeons. That's mm-hmm. part of their commitment. Yeah, I think it's still a challenging question.
Well, Amy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
That was Amy Foster, a University of Central Florida space historian focusing on technology and gender. That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to this show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Stay connected with the show. Be sure to follow us on social media. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook. We're AWTY Space. And if you've got an idea for a future episode of this show or you want to join us as a guest, reach out to us. We're AWTY@cfpublic.org. We've got more space coverage online. Visit cfpublic.org/space. Are We There Yet? Is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our host is Brennan Byrne. Our producer is me, Marion Summerall. Our intern is Jenna Weiss. Editorial guidance from Latoya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet? Comes from our listeners. I'm Marion Summerall, and Brennan will be back next week. Thanks for listening.